Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Welcome to the Ethics Experts. I am here with Shannon Walker. How are you, Shannon?
I'm great. Thanks, Nick. How are you doing?
I am great. Thanks so much for joining us today. I've been excited to get you on the Ethics Experts since we met. And thanks for joining us.
No problem. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, we've been talking. We're in full-on coronavirus scare down here, and I'm sure it's the same up by you. But how has that affected your business so far?
Well, it's actually interesting. It has affected us specifically in our office because we have one employee who's self-isolating due to potential exposure. We've also had guests who've been needing to visit for quite some time who've had to cancel their plans due to corporate head office directive.
Right.
And we are finding as well that we are getting a lot of calls through our hotline from people who are wondering about what to do about the coronavirus. They're reporting on colleagues who they think potentially could be sick. So it's creating an uptake in our call volume, and it's just, I mean, it's something that's just unprecedented.
Yeah, so it is unprecedented, and we're seeing some, you know, different reactions from different clients and different companies really across the board. How do you see kind of some of your clients kind of handling it, and what do you think some of the best things you've seen are?
Well, I think the best things I've seen so far are those companies that are proactively addressing it and communicating to their employees about potential pandemic strategies, and certainly doing the evaluation of the ability of those employees that need to work remotely, and taking into consideration as well those employees who have young children or elderly parents that may need additional support and additional ability to self-isolate so that their family members aren't infected. So it's, I find right now as well is that everybody is really sort of hunkering down and doing the self-assessment or the corporate-wide assessment. So it is a bit of a distraction from day-to-day business as everyone is trying to figure out what the best strategy is.
Yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of the same things. And I think time will tell whether it was too much or not enough or too little too late or what. But it is, as you said, totally unprecedented.
Yeah, it's a strange new world. But certainly, I think with both of us being in the business that we're in, it's a great opportunity for us to support our clients in whatever way we can and augmenting our contact center sort of experience to help them triage those calls that are related to the coronavirus and people's worries and needs and need for more information.
Yeah, that's a great point. Why don't we kind of rewind a little bit, and why don't you tell our listeners kind of who you are, the business that you're in, and how you help kind of drive cultures and drive ethics and compliance, across the world.
Okay. So my company is Whistleblower Security, which I founded about 15 years ago, and we do service clients all over the world. And our mandate and our ethos really is about making good companies better. So people that choose to work with us, I think, are committed to supporting their organization, to supporting their employees, to try and create a stronger culture, a more open culture, and create opportunities and strategies for their employees who feel they can't go to the direct supervisor for whatever reason, then they still have a path to speak up. And through our hotline service, through our Integrity Counts platform, and through all of the support that we do with our clients to ensure, one, we're kind of replicating and advocating their corporate vernacular, I think that we become a very good partner to those organizations that really want to be better at what they do and the environment that they provide for their employees and for their clients as well.
So when you get involved with an organization, you know, you said you make good companies better. When you get involved with an organization, how much of what you're doing for them is executing their playbook versus you bringing sort of expertise or, you know, additional spices to the dish?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think that when a client decides to come to us, they're already somewhat down the path in exploring and knowing that there's opportunities to improve or enhance whatever their playbook currently is. And so our tool, our platform, I think is one cog in that overall wheel. And so when I say making good companies better, I think that when they decide that they want to put an ethics and compliance program into place, they're already that much more evolved in that path to creating a really inclusive environment for their employees. And I also think that companies that do engage in a really strong ethics and compliance program also speak volumes to the types of organization that they are and a value-based perspective to their client base. So I think there's sort of a, I don't know if I want to call it a tipping effect or a, but there is an effect that goes beyond just, you know, the internal structures, because I think it also speaks volumes to your external stakeholders about who you are as a company when you really do embrace a strong ethics program.
So tell me some more about that. I think there's something really interesting in what you're talking about. And I think some organizations who don't have those light bulbs on at the top, so to speak, miss this point that you're making.
Okay. So I can think of, I'll think of an old client of ours who had a really well-developed, sophisticated ethics program. And they embedded their ethics program and the values of the foundation of that ethics program throughout the entire organization. So it wasn't something that they talked about once a year. It's something that they embedded in all of their training, all of their review programs, in their health and wellness program. It was part of their DNA. And because of that, they had super high retention. They had super high engagement. And even though ethics was it was part of the conversation all the time, and you'd sort of expect that maybe we wouldn't get a lot of calls on the hotline because they were just an ethically enhanced organization, we still got a lot of calls on the hotline because people would actually call if they saw someone not living up to the values of the organization. And there was this expectation that they could all do better. I had huge admiration for this organization, as well as the team that ran the program, because it was part of their whole sort of moral code, really. And what I found is that like that organization, compared to some of our other clients who perhaps tick the box and they need to have an ethics program or they need to have a hotline to fulfill a regulatory requirement, the essence of the organization is far different. And I do think that there is a retention and an engagement component that is enhanced when you have a strong ethics and compliance program.
It's sort of a foundation for the culture. And like you said, that foundation can build a sort of skyscraper of engagement and a skyscraper of high intention that is not really possible without that lifeblood running through the company.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think I find, even within our organization at Whistleblower, I think that our employees are that much more engaged because of what we do. And I think that they're committed to this company and committed to the platform and committed to our clients, because we all feel like we're doing something that has real intrinsic value to it.
Yeah.
We're really helping people. And that's sort of that's why I think, I mean, you and I both, I think, feel this. It's a great place to be. And it's certainly a great place to be in this time and place in the business world, because again, over the last decade, you know, you just see the talk of ethics becomes more and more prominent. And I think the feeling that people have to be engaged and honest and upfront and transparent becomes more and more of a priority as we've experienced so many scandals and leadership disappointments over the years. And there's a huge paradigm shift from just doing deals and doing whatever it takes to get deals done to doing deals, but doing them the right way.
Yeah, and what do you think's behind that paradigm shift?
Well, I think there's been a, you know, a lot of high publicized, really unfortunate incidents. And I think that, well, I mean, the regulators have certainly helped, but I think that there's a consciousness of, you know, it's time to take a deeper look and time to take a look at how people are doing business and how the ethics of doing business is so imperative and so important for the overall wellness of the stock market, of business, of politics. And at some point, there has to be a calling to doing things the right way, because not only are organizations risking their reputations and their financial wherewithal when they're sort of skirting the right way of doing things, but you have to think about the employee base and also the investors who are out there who's, you know, if you take a look at, say, Enron or Tyco and all of the money that was wiped out, all of the people's retirements and pensions that were wiped out because of an ethical behavior. I just think that all of these events have led us to this point in time where, you know, 15 years ago, there weren't chief ethics officers in organizations. Now that's a commonplace position and a really important position that usually reports up to the CEO. So you can kind of see how business has evolved to ensure that ethics and compliance is part of the overall business management.
Yeah. And, you know, we're talking about this evolution. And I think a generation ago, a business was set up to make money only. And that was the sole purpose of it. But I feel like there's some more dimensionality to a business's purpose today. And I don't know if that's a generational shift or if that's just this evolution that you're talking about, or it's been spurred on by these, you know, scandals or things like that, but there definitely does seem to be a shift. What do you think about how organizations, or talk a little bit about the difference between organizations that kind of are kind of more check the box, where, you know, this ethical, you know, this chief ethics officer, this sort of compliance function is sort of an imposition in response to a regulation, as opposed to an organization that you kind of gave an example to earlier, that takes that and runs with it. Where do you think the breakdown is on this spectrum of organization?
Well, I don't, you know, that one's a tough one. And I don't know if it's so much a breakdown of the organizations. I just think that there's still those organizations that haven't evolved. I think that, you know, the companies that we really like to work with are those ones who are a bit more sophisticated and are really, really concerned and committed to ensuring that their reputational aspect out there in the community is as the highest that it could be. It's interesting, we did a national survey in Canada last year, and we found that 94% of Canadian employees felt it is their responsibility to speak up when they see wrongdoing in the workplace. And when you look at overall the number of companies that have the capabilities or have the methods or have the services to allow people to safely speak up and comfortably speak up, it's less than 45% of organizations have a whistleblower system in place. So there's still a disconnect. I know it's fascinating, isn't it? You'd think with all of the regulations that have come into place and with all of the, you know, again, all of the scandals, you think that more organizations would be proactive about embracing this. In Canada, we're still a little bit behind. I think in the US, you're ahead of us on whistleblower hotline adoption. But I think that people are wanting to speak up and people are wanting to engage. And so those companies that are more sophisticated are putting the tools in place to allow them to speak up. And there's
that's
a super, you know, again.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say that that's a really interesting statistic. So 9 out of 10 people in Canada think it's their duty to speak up, and less than half of the organizations have a whistleblowing mechanism in place for people to speak up. I'm just trying to wrap my head around that, because I'd imagine that
94%
is not just like frontline workers that you know. I'd imagine that this that's a high enough percentage that it's probably representative of like the entire population up and down, you know, an organization's, you know, management structure.
Hierarchy?
Yeah.
No, absolutely. It's not just frontline. It's a frontline management. It was a really broad base of a survey that we did. And it was kind of fascinating that, especially in a place like Canada, that is so progressive on so many sort of mm-hmm. social policies and business right. practices, and that we don't have a lot of companies with whistleblower hotlines. The other interesting statistic was that it was something like 25% of the employees who didn't have a whistleblower service, or who did have a whistleblower hotline, didn't know how to access it. So that's a whole other, and I mean, we can speak to that too. So, you know, there's companies that have the hotline, like the one that I talked about before, who just, you know, it was everywhere. It was well publicized. Everyone was aware of it. Everyone was encouraged to use it. But then there are those organizations who do have it and do speak to it, but, you know, maybe fall down a little bit when it gets to the point of ensuring that people know how to get through to it.
And I mean, how do you explain that? How do you explain that? Or what do you attribute that to? Because all these statistics are extremely interesting. Again, particularly slated on the Canadian thing, which to your point is more progressive and so forth.
Well, I think, you know, I think sometimes where organizations fall down is in the inability to kind of have a cross silo mandate. So sometimes, you know, the ethics and compliance program, maybe it's under HR, maybe it's under legal, maybe it's in its own ethics and compliance department. But the reality is that you really need to have managers across the entire organization embrace it. And so if you've got operations and you've got finance and they're not speaking to HR and not really incorporating HR policies to a greater extent, and sometimes that hotline and that service gets lost in the mix. And so that's where I think it really needs to be embedded across every department in the organization, so that it can truly be effective and truly be embraced.
So do you feel like it's a function of just siloing within an organization as it grows? I mean, I don't think it's probably somebody saying, okay, well, now we got the hotline, let's just kind of hide it. Is it like, what makes this particular tool become an afterthought? I mean, because 25% is not a small number, and 45% is a very big number. So effectively, mm-hmm. we're talking about almost a third of people, more than half of the people, a third of the people know how to use hotlines up there, or have a hotline and know how to use it. That's a small portion of the population.
Right.
So
yeah,
I don't think it's intentional.
I know it's a, yeah. No, it's, I don't think it's intentional either. I think businesses get caught up in doing the business of their business. Mm-hmm. And even I find, and you might've had this experience too, even when a company is, doing the diligence in looking at incorporating an ethics program into their organization, that in itself can take months or even years to get moving and to get implemented, because right. it's not a priority, right? So the business of the business is definitely the priority. And sometimes these internal tools and programs are, you know, they might get implemented, but they actually don't get embraced.
Yeah, it's kind of silly though. It's kind of like somebody saying, well, I'll start exercising once I have time. I'm going to start sleeping when I have time.
That's exactly what it's like. So next week I'm going to make it to the gym 4 times and then it never happens. And that's, you know, so we all have good intentions. Right. And it's a matter of, you know, executing on your good intentions and ensuring that you create that habit, right? So same thing, I think, with the whistleblower hotline, is that there needs to be a habit in place and there needs to be this sort of constant touch point. And if you're not touching it and you're not highlighting it regularly and in different ways as well, I think that, you know, again, we've got some clients who probably just review the code of ethics once a year during the employee review and then it gets put back in the drawer. That's not going to drive a really strong ethics program.
So let's talk about ethics and compliance in HR as a leg on the stool of strategy. You kind of touched on it a little bit before, but what do you think is the mental block that leaders have around these functions that maybe are obviously in their mind not part of the business of their business? What do you think that's rooted in?
Well, I personally think it's rooted in some old school myopic thinking, but certainly, and this term is so overused, but that tone of the top, I do believe holds some true credence, because if you don't have, your very top management team embracing this and saying this is a priority, then it's not going to filter down through the ranks. And so in that sense, if bottom line is all that matters to an organization, and this is an afterthought, it's not going to be a very successful program. And I also would say that it's not going to positively affect the corporate culture.
Tell us more about that. That's a good point.
I think that, it's so many organizations have good intentions, but good intentions don't drive cultural change. And I think that, again, this sort of the cross-silo approach, and maybe this can be used in your analogy of the stool, but every leg on that stool has to support ultimately the organization. And so with the legs on the stool being either the cross-silo departments along with programs out of each of those silos that interact. This is a good point too. I'm thinking of another organization that has an ethics and compliance hotline and has a loss prevention hotline, both in just for their internal stakeholders. Yet both of those hotlines and the reports that come through those hotlines are managed by independent teams that don't speak to each other.
Interesting.
And so you can have some reports that are related that aren't being managed and investigated across the silos. And you're missing a lot of opportunities to identify issues, to correct those issues, to make changes in the organization. And so that client that we were working with was really, once this was sort of identified, really made strides to bring those teams together and to coordinate the investigation and the corrections that needed to happen within the organization. But it was a rant, and that was a random find.
Oh, like who found that? You guys found that? You said, hey, this makes sense. Or somebody inside was like, wait, why are these two different functions investigating similar stuff? Why aren't they collaborating?
Exactly. We were working on one side of the business and ended up meeting with the other side of the business and then said, we need to actually work together with all of you and have a holistic database of management, because there's stuff that's getting missed. And I think that's interesting when you were talking too, as companies grow, the silos become even more mm-hmm. separate. And those are where the opportunities for more issues to happen. So if a company is smaller, there's an opportunity to put these sort of systems into place and have a cross-silo team manage them, especially when they're small. And then as they grow, the challenges are significantly larger for sure, but I just think that this cross-silo management of something like this is really important to identify those issues and be able to correct them.
So the clients that you deal with on a day-to-day basis, they are within these functions that sometimes are siloed, that sometimes are, a tween at the little kid's table, so to speak. Sometimes they're in an organization that doesn't view that the light bulb at the top hasn't been turned on for them to see what kind of a massive impact, cultural impact, that these functions being empowered and unleashed can have on the things that the people at the top care about, which is namely the bottom line. How do we help people in these ethics and compliance departments or in these HR departments who are looked at as cost centers, who have been kind of pigeonholed? How do we help them elevate their functions?
Oh, that is an excellent question. I think there's a couple of ways. I think one, if you can try and show a return on investment to those people. So I always say, if you uncover one issue that either results in some sort of financial restitution or results in a toxic individual being terminated, right there is your effect on the bottom line. I also think we have something called a product advisory council, where we bring a bunch of disparate clients together to talk about their best practices, to talk about what they like about their ethics and compliance programs, and to have that capability to share with their peers across a diverse industry base is really important. And I think that to share with their peers, to understand how to, again, not sell their bosses, but justify their teams and justify investment in their teams. Because I do find, and I don't know if Nick, if you found this, but a lot of our key relationships within organizations are very under-resourced. Yeah. So the ethics and compliance teams are just, it is hard for them to get budget. And so again, if they can use some of the metrics that that come out of our database for their ethics and compliance program and show the types of outcomes that are happening, I think that's quite powerful. Just even the ability to show the percentage of cases that are being substantiated and validated, I think is a really, really good metric for them to take to their bosses to say, this year I had 50 cases of which 75 were substantiated, resulting in X dollars saved or X dollars recovered or what have you.
So why is that so hard for folks, do you think? Because, I mean, look, yes, they're super under-resourced, so that could be a piece of it. Many tools that they're using have sort of reporting built in, but why is that hard, do you think, for them to ultimately make that bottom line connection and drive that persuasion to get more budget? Because I agree, they're totally under-resourced and they're totally underutilized from a strategic asset perspective.
Yeah, and that's a really good point about the underutilized as a strategic asset situation, because I think that they are so integral to the operations of the business. And I do think, again, the paradigm shift is happening where they're becoming a bigger player at the table and they've got a seat at the adult table now, at least in some organizations. Mm-hmm. But to that point, I think because of the nature of being under-resourced and the nature of being sometimes cast away, they're not taking the time to make their case to upper management. Again, because they're sort of in the weeds for a lot of it, and just migrating through giant volumes of calls and investigations. And I think to take the time to sit and look at those statistics and look at their effect on the bottom line, or at least look in their, I think there's also a qualitative perspective that can be taken about how it's affecting the culture. And so even to be doing regular engagement surveys so that you can, have that type of interactive feedback beyond the hotline. But to say, since we've instituted the hotline, these are the metrics that have improved with our employee engagement survey.
The engagement is such a big piece of the puzzle because it's kind of that silent killer. If you can drive engagement up of your employees by 5 or 10%, what does that translate into? If you can drive your turnover
down,
that's
a really interesting question.
I mean, those are real dollars. Those are real efficiencies that companies are losing, but they don't realize it.
No, that's exactly right. I think that gets lost in the mix too. And I think if an ethics and compliance department really looked at how their retention program was going and worked again cross silo with HR to really understand how retention and recruitment are being affected by their or influenced by their ethics program, then they'd have a much stronger argument to their management team about the value that they're bringing to the table.
So you guys have a great culture. You and I kind of nerd out on this stuff, and I think as you've told me about your culture and as I've sort of seen it in action, online and things like that, like there's a certain authenticity to it that really resonates with me. And I'd love for you to kind of talk a little bit about how you've been so intentional with the culture that you've built.
You know, it's funny that you say we nerd out, because I guess we really kind of, you know, in this space are a bit nerdy. And certainly, I don't know if you've found this, but when people ask me what I do and I tell them, they're always sort of struck and confused. They didn't know a business like this could even exist.
Right.
And one of the things that I have to say about being in this business and having the team that we have at Whistleblower is that everybody is really passionate about what we do. And we really feel that we are helping organizations create better places for their employees and be better stewards in general. And one of the things that we do is, I think, you know, we're pretty flatline across our management. So we're very inclusive and we're very collaborative. And that's been a really important component of the culture that we've created. And I think that, you know, we have things like a vegetable garden and the dogs come to work, and we're pretty flexible with our hours and ensuring that people have good work-life balance and all of that. Like we want people to really enjoy coming to work, but also we really, really value that everyone's got busy lives outside of work. And so we really try and incorporate everyone's needs to ensure that they're supported and then and can still really do their jobs well. So it's I have to say, I feel very blessed that that we have such a great team and continue to recruit really good people who really want to do something that has sort of a higher calling to a certain extent. You know, I think that I'm very happy that we don't sell widgets. Really happy that we do. Do provide services and partner with our clients to support them in whatever their issues are or their challenges are, and continue to do that. And even when we partner with other vendors to provide services to our clients, we always assess their corporate culture as well, because we certainly don't want to bring other vendors to our clients. They don't really speak the same corporate vernacular as us. And one of the other things that we're doing right now is we're going through a B Corp certification, which is about creating a company of impact. And that's, you know, impact on our people, impact on our planet, impact on our corporate culture, to ensure that we're always considering doing the right thing for our employees, for our partners, and for our community.
So I love that kind of holistic approach in recognizing that your organization's reach goes beyond the bank account, and it goes beyond even just the clients that you're interacting with, but it's going out into your community, and it's going out into the homes really of the people that are part of your team. I would love for you to kind of talk about that a little bit more with respect to the vendor relationship, because you have vendors, I have vendors. We have we strive to create a culture that's, you know, authentic, like a lot of the elements that you described. And what I'd like to kind of get into is how important that vendor culture is for, you know, a buyer of said vendor services, and how much that should or shouldn't be a consideration in that decision.
Ooh, okay, that's a big question. I think, you know, one of our mandates, and this is even before we went through the B Corp certification process, is that we're very much into supporting our local community. So, you know, our head office is in a bedroom community outside of Vancouver. We really try and support all of the local independent retailers that are right around our head office. And even our coffee service at the office is a local coffee maker here in Vancouver. We try and source, you know, again, products and services that are local. And it's really because it's about supporting small business. And it's also about having sort of that, I think we have a higher level of premium service delivery because of our relationship with local providers. Having said that, you know, we've got partners in Australia and partners in the UK. But again, they tend to be smaller organizations that are a cultural fit and really try and replicate sort of, I don't want to be too prescriptive about it, but try and replicate our corporate vernacular, which is about, you know, which is, it is about, you know, creating a great place for people to work and providing the, providing relationships that to sort of emulate our own, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, imagine a gourmet chef just getting, you know, rotten tomatoes for the salad, right? Like they want the best ingredients that are going to go into the dishes that they're making. I mean, that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah, it is. It's about premium. It's about premium service. And again, of course, sometimes we're going to work with really large organizations that are multinationals, providing some, you know, I don't know, cloud service or something like that. But to have the opportunity to choose vendors and partners that are like-minded, I think is really important. And again, it's an extension of our corporate culture. So I just think it speaks volumes and it helps us all, you know, live those values day to day.
So let's kind of flip that question on its head. And how important, you know, or I guess kind of dive into that with respect to the services that you provide, how important is the culture of empathy, which is really what we're kind of talking about here. How important is that culture, is that cultural element in a vendor that's providing sort of incident intake services and hotline services for a purpose-driven organization or from an ethics and compliance organization that's really trying to make a difference in their company?
I think the empathy is core to everything. And again, that's one of our core values. And certainly from an intake perspective, when someone calls the whistleblower hotline, they can be completely unnerved. They can be nervous. They can be emotionally distressed. And our directive to all of our team is that we are going to provide the warmest, most comforting, empathetic environment for that caller when they finally decide to reach out. Again, people put their lives at risk. They put their careers at risk. They put their reputations at risk when they decide to speak out. And they need to be acknowledged for how brave and courageous they are. So from our perspective, if one of our intake specialists has to take 4 hours on a call, that's fine. Because our first mandate is to ensure that that whistleblower feels safe and comforted and is supported throughout that call. And then the second mandate, of course, is to get as much information as possible from them to help our client do any kind of investigation that has to happen. So the empathy is a huge driver within our organization, both not only from the, you know, our frontline intake specialist, but throughout the organization. And it's something that is, I think, front and foremost for us in our service delivery. We say that we're, you know, we deliver human-powered ethics programs, and that's because the humanness is the thing that differentiates us from a lot of other contact center environments. You know, we don't assess our agents on call handle time. Again, if they take 2 hours, they take 4 hours, that's fine, as long as they ensure that that person is protected and comforted when they're calling us.
So I think this is a really important point, particularly for, you know, so I'm just going to kind of paint a picture here. There's an ethics and compliance officer or office who recognizes the strategic impact that their organization can have on their broader organization that they're a part of. They are looking for an incident. They're looking for an incident intake solution. How do they equip themselves to dig out the type of experience that their callers, who are their employees, the people that they're stewards of, are going to have, and how do they work that into the broader picture of solution delivery, boxes that I need to check from a sort of objective standpoint, and then also kind of the feeling that they want those people to have?
Okay, so that's a really interesting question, because I do find that when people are searching and doing the due diligence for a tool or a service like ours, they do go through that checklist, and it's about the technology, it's about the security, it's about the functionality,
reporting.
It's
right.
Yeah, the reporting. And again, assessing the humanness of the service delivery does get lost in that diligence process.
I agree.
And I think it's probably, it's a really important component of it. And so you can go through your checklist and get everything checked off. And then if the ultimate experience for the caller is one where he feels like he's ordering a Boston pizza, which is a chain up here in Canada. I don't think you have it down there, but,
yeah.
You know, we're not about pizza delivery. We're not order takers,
right?
We are, I think we're, this is where I go. We like, you want a partner in this environment that is a collaborator, a supporter, an empathetic shoulder, really.
Well,
and so, you know, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, part of the problem, and I'm just going to say it, is how the salespeople end up pitching it and how they end up sort of guiding the person through the process. If it's kind of look at the birdie, look at the graphs, look at the functionality of the website, and they deprioritize the thing that actually is going to affect the culture first and foremost, it ends up focusing people on the things that are really, in my view of the world, a little bit less important, particularly to the extent that, you know, these trends are in place everywhere. You know, am I going to speak up? What does that experience look like? You know, is it hard to report? Is it not? Is there empathy when I call in, and am I treated like a human? Those are the things that are going to end up rippling through the culture, not the graphs or the dashboards in the office of 5 to 15 people that are managing those cases.
Yeah, that is such a good point. And you know, from that perspective, one of our business development managers is a former intake specialist who started with our business taking those whistleblower calls and then trained the whistleblower agents and then now actually sells the service. And what I love is that she has the perspective and the insights of being there on the front line, taking those calls from people who are crying and distressed.
Right.
And now she's actually selling the service. And so she can really bring a perspective that not very many people can really relate to. And so to that point, I think that if you are talking to a salesperson who's being very metric driven and here's the dashboard, you need to take a step back. You're absolutely right. What kind of experience are my employees going to have when they finally use this service? I think it's imperative that it is a very human, very warm, and very supportive experience for those people.
Yeah, and like you said, if the intake specialists are viewing the callers as another number, as just another sort of voice on the end of the phone, and not viewing them as a human who maybe was driving to work with a knot in their stomach yet again, who went home with a stomach ache yet again, who couldn't sleep yet again because they're being abused at work or because they saw something and they're going through this internal battle of, should I speak up? I feel the need to, I feel compelled to. And there's none of that, you know, I guess we're talking about empathy again. There's none of that empathy there. The experience of that person calling in is going to be starkly different than if they're calling into a place like yours, where there's none of those sort of objective metrics, you know, choking the intake specialist and really dehumanizing them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's and that's why, again, I think that we really like to think of ourselves as a boutique service where we're creating an experience. So it's not just about our, you know, we've got great security and great technology, but it's an experience that we're creating for the organization and for all of their stakeholders.
Where can people learn more about you and your company, and where can they find you?
Well, if they can go to our website, which is whistleblowersecurity.com, and there's a lot of great information on the website and videos and ebooks on creating great cultures and all the rest of that. So I welcome anybody who'd like to learn a little bit more to reach out to us there.
And is that survey that you guys did on your website too? I think there's some really cool statistics in there that probably are going to translate at least directionally, regardless of which side of the border that folks are on.
Yes, and that's a good point, actually. We always, you know, up here in Canada, we always sort of extrapolate any kind of results and say, basically you times them by 10. The Americas and Canadian cultures are very, very similar. I mean, there's some vast differences, but a lot of the, I think the shared values of Canadians are replicated throughout the United States as well. Yeah. So there's an infographic, I believe, on the website that can be downloaded with the sort of the highlights of the statistics that we found. And, it was really, to me, it was really reaffirming that, the survey spoke to that people want to speak up and they feel it's their responsibility to speak up. And they also feel that employees should be protected and have safeguards if they do decide to speak up. And that's a really important point that we didn't really talk about today, but ensuring that people aren't retaliated against when they do speak up, I think is a really important objective for companies to ensure that they promote and that they follow through with, because again, people are risking their lives and their careers and their reputations when they do speak up, and they're speaking up because they want to do the right thing.
Yeah. They're speaking up because they care. They feel some obligation to do it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it was in this survey. They felt it was their responsibility.
That's something that any business would want to foster, I would imagine. Or, I mean, I want to foster that in my business. I mean, I want to make sure that things are being done properly, not to get people in trouble, but just so we can root out problems and, correct things and making sure that, the dishes that are coming out of the kitchen are well cooked, Right, exactly.
So, 100%.
Yeah. So I just, I'm so glad that I met you. It's, we're in the same business, but I feel like a kindred spirit with you. I love that there's other folks out there that are trying to make the world a better workplace, that are putting people above profits and kind of focusing on the long term. So I just love what you guys are doing. I love the impact that you're making, and I love your heart for the impact that you can make on your clients' employees' lives, because that's really an exciting thing to do to make the world better.
Thanks, Nick. I know it's been great meeting you as well. And I do feel that we're kindred spirits. I think that we're both committed to one, providing great work environments for our own teams, but two, to extending that out to all of our clients and their employees. So I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today. And I look forward to more conversations.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Shannon.